Okay, so I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for organizing an excellent conference and for inviting me here. The talk will be based on some work done with in collaboration with Rastelia and Zoibach during the last 6 months, and is basically reported on in these papers and is also reviewed in this paper. And very related work has been done by Gross and Taylor, and you will hear more about it tomorrow from David Gross's lecture. So the first few transparencies will be more or less a repetition of what Barton talked about this morning, but so I'll go through them quickly. The object of study will be deep brains in bosonic string theory, and we will take for our space-time background any arbitrary two-dimensional bulk conformal field theory of total central charge 26. A deep brain in such space-time background will be described by some boundary conformal field theory, which I'll denote in short as by BCFT, and this corresponds to a conformal field theory in the upper half plane with some specific boundary conditional fields on the real axis. And what boundary condition we put on the real axis determines which particular deep brain we are describing. And as trivial example, in flat space-time, Neumann boundary condition on a coordinate corresponds to the coordinate tangential to the deep brain, and Dirichlet boundary condition on a coordinate corresponds to a direction transverse to the deep brain. But in general, there are more complicated boundary conditions. Now, throughout this talk, we shall work with a fixed bulk conformal field theory corresponding to some fixed space-time background in bosonic string theory, and we will never try to change this background. Each deep brain in this background contains at least one tachyonic mode, as is reflected in the fact that every such deep brain has a state of this form, and the local minimum of the tachyon potential is conjectured to describe closed string vacuum without any deep brain. So around this vacuum there are no open string excitations, and the question that we are interested in here is what is the action that describes the open string field theory action expanded around the tachyon vacuum. So here is the proposal for string field theory action around the tachyon vacuum. This has been described in detail by Barton this morning. So we'll denote by BCFT naught a specific reference boundary conformal field theory corresponding to some particular deep brain in the chosen space-time background. And again, throughout this talk, we'll fix BCFT naught once and for all. We'll never try to change BCFT naught. Okay, this is some fixed reference boundary conformal field theory. We'll denote by H the combined matter ghost state space of the first quantized open strings associated with BCFT naught. So these are states of the open string living on the deep brain described by BCFT naught. And for the string field, we'll take this to be a state of ghost number 1 in the Silver space, or in the state space. The action for the string field was written down by Barton in the morning. It's given by this expression over here. This symbol denotes BPZ inner product in BCFT naught. A star B is the Witten star product, which is a map from the product of two copies of H to H. G is the open string coupling constant. And Q is the new kinetic operator, which is constrained to satisfy some relations. So we take for Q to be an operator which is made purely of the BC ghost fields and which satisfies a set of constraints. First of all, it has to satisfy the constraint that it's nilpotent, it distributes over star product, and it's Hermitian in this sense. And these three conditions guarantee that the string field theory action A sub psi that I wrote down in the last transparency is invariant under a gauge transformation of this kind, where lambda is any state of ghost number 0 in H. The second condition on Q is that it should have trivial cohomology, and this is what guarantees that there are no perturbative physical open string states in the vacuum psi equal to 0. And so psi equal to 0 is the end point of tachyon condensation. And as Barton pointed out this morning, there are clearly many examples of Q that satisfy these constraints. Okay. Here is a general class of operators Q, which are linear combinations of Cn and C minus n of this kind. Okay. And I should say that there could in principle be other candidate operators for Q which involves more complicated operators which are not just linear linear in C, but which may also involve higher order terms involving B and C. In any case, we will proceed without committing ourselves to any specific choice of Q, and the question that we will be addressing is, can we construct classical solutions in this string field theory which describe various d-brains in this theory? And in this class of classical solutions, we look for those, a particular classical solution which include d-brain corresponding to the reference boundary conformal field theory, namely BCFT naught, but also of any other BCFT, which you can denote in general by BCFTI for various values of I. And we will also like to construct solutions that describe superposition of any set of d-brains, described by different boundary conformal field theories. So, the equations of motion in this theory are given by this, and because Q is made purely of ghosts, we can look for factorized solution, again as Barton discussed in the morning, where the string field is just a product of a ghost part and a matter part. And if we substitute this into the equation of motion, we can easily see that the equation of motion splits into two different parts. The first part says that the Q on the ghost part plus psi g star psi g is 0, and the second part of the equation says that psi m, the matter part of the string field, is a projection operator. And I should just add here is that in principle you could have put a normalization factor n here and n inverse here, it will still satisfy this equation, and this normalization factor depends on how exactly you split psi into psi g and psi m. So you could have written psi as n psi g cross n inverse psi m and split the equation slightly differently. Now, to proceed further, we will make a further ansatz which we will call the universality ansatz, and this ansatz says that all d-brain configurations in this theory are described by classical solutions with the same ghost part psi g but different matter parts. So, different d-brains will all have same psi g but different psi m. Now, this universality ansatz allows us to calculate the tension of the d-brains or the ratios of tensions of d-brains without explicit knowledge of the ghost sector in the following way. So, if we take a classical solution of that factorized form and evaluate the value of the action for the classical solution, then this is the value of the action for the classical solution, and you can see that this splits into a ghost factor which is universal because psi g is the same for all d-brain solutions, and then there is a matter part which of course changes as you go from one d-brain to another d-brain. Well, we would like to have psi g such that psi g q psi g is non-zero, because otherwise this is not going to describe a regular d-brain. At least the product should be non-zero. So when you calculate the ratio, this will describe the ratio of these quantities. So you certainly would like to have this whole thing non-zero. So given this, we can calculate the ratio of masses of two different d-brain configurations simply by calculating the ratios of the BPZ inner products of psi m prime, and psi m, psi m. And this in principle can be calculated without knowing the ghost sector contribution. Once you have found a solution of the matter sector equations, we can simply calculate the ratio and try to compute the ratio of the tensions of the d-brains that way. So the task is that given any d-brain configuration, we want to find a string field psi m describing that solution. And I should note here again that even though we will try to construct d-brains corresponding to different boundary conformal field theories, the string field psi m always takes value in HM, namely the matter part of the state space of BCFT naught. String field never takes value in Hilbert space of anything other than BCFT naught. And this means that we can specify psi m by simply specifying the inner product of psi m with any arbitrary state in HM. And that's the way we'll try to specify what the string, the solution is. So now I'll give a construction of the solutions, and then I'll try to give a proof as to why they are solutions of the equations of motion. So the step one in this construction is the following. We choose a set of conjugate pair of vortex operators, which I'll denote by chi I plus minus, I running from 1 to up to n, depends on how many dibrands you want to construct, which satisfy the following two properties. First of all, chi I minus denotes the matter part of the vortex operator for a state of the open string, which begins on BCFT not dibrand and ends on a BCFT I dibrand. Now, as a vortex operator inserted on a real axis, what this means is that when you insert chi I minus on the real axis, the left part of the vortex operator has BCFT I boundary condition, the right part has BCFT not boundary condition. And chi I plus does exactly the opposite. Okay, it starts from a BCFT I dibrand and ends on a BCFT not dibrand. So these are a conjugate pair of vortex operators of this chi. The second condition that this set of operators chi I plus minus need to satisfy is some kind of orthonormality condition, that the operator expansion of chi I minus of x with chi j plus of y has this form. There is a delta ij. If I is not equal to j, there is no contribution from the identity operator. So chi I minus of x with chi j plus of y has the leading contribution in this operator expansion is y minus x to the minus 2 hi delta ij, and then there are operators of dimension larger than 0. Hi here is simply the conformal weight of chi I plus minus. And we are going to use this vortex operator to construct our string field. And we'll see how. So step two, we define a state xi I. This is the generalization of the sliver state that Barton introduced in the morning. This state xi I belongs to H, the state space of BCFT naught. What is the definition of xi I? At this stage, I should say that I am dealing with the full matter ghost conformal field theory. I'll split into the matter part later. So the inner product of xi I with any state phi in H is given by this expression over here. Epsilon is any positive real number. Hi, as I have already said, is the dimensions of chi I plus minus. F dot, phi of 0, of course, is the vortex operator that creates the state phi with whom you are trying to compute the inner product. F dot phi of 0 is simply the conformal transform of phi by the conformal map F. F of z is tan inverse of z. This appeared in Barton's definition of the sliver state in the morning. I'll later describe the relationship between these states and the sliver. And then we insert a factor of chi I minus at minus pi by 4 minus epsilon, chi I plus at pi by 4 plus epsilon, and calculate the 3-point correlation function on the upper half plane. So if you want to see what it means geometrically, here is a real axis. We insert a chi I minus at minus pi by 4 minus epsilon. We insert an f dot phi at the origin. We insert a chi I plus at pi by 4 plus epsilon. And this means that from the definition of chi I plus and chi I minus, we have BCFT I boundary condition in this part of the real axis, BCFT not boundary condition on this part of the real axis, and again BCFT I boundary condition on this part of the real axis. And the fact that phi is an element of H is reflected in the fact that we are inserting phi in a region of the real axis where we have BCFT not boundary condition. Otherwise, of course, we couldn't have inserted phi in this region. So this then completely defines what we mean by this state xi I, because this defines the inner product of xi I with any state in the Hilbert space of BCFT naught. Yeah.
In terms of the sliver picture that we drew, where are these?
Yeah. So, for example, if we take chi I plus minus to be identity operators, this is just the sliver, because he wrote down the definition of the sliver state on the, as a matrix element on the real, on the upper half plane. Yeah, I'll describe the disk picture here. How it's related to the disk picture. At this stage, we simply think of it as an upper correlation function in the upper half plane. In fact, I'll also describe the how to regulate this to make it into the wedge states. The relationship with the wedge states. So this is the definition of the state xi I, and I'll now write down the properties of this state xi I, and then I'll show how to prove the properties. So here are some results. The first result is the following, that with this definition of the chi i's and the definition of the xi i, of the state xi i, first of all we have the relation that xi I star xi j is delta ij times xi I. And this means that if we now write xi I as, if we factor xi I into its ghost part and the matter part, and from the definition of xi I it should be clear that the ghost part is totally independent of I, because after all in the definition of xi I all the I dependence came from the matter part. Okay, I dependence came basically from the chi I plus and chi I minus, which are purely matter vortex operators. So you can write xi I as the product of a ghost piece and a matter piece. Okay. And now if we normalize our ghost piece so that it squares to itself, xi g star xi g equal to xi g, then that it follows that the corresponding matter part also squares to itself. Okay. In other words, xi I m star xi m j is delta I j times xi m I. That just follows from this relation. And so you see that if we take for the matter part of the string field psi m as xi m I, then this is the candidate solution of the equations of motion psi m star psi m equal to psi m. We can also take psi m to be a superposition of these states, okay, just sum over I xi I m, and from this relation it follows that psi m star psi m is still equal to psi m. Okay, it satisfies the equations of motion. The second relation is concerns the BPZ norm of the state xi I m. What one can show is that the BPZ norm of xi I m or the BPZ inner product between xi I m and xi m j is proportional to delta I j times the partition function of the BCFT I. Okay. So C is a constant independent of I and z I is a partition function of BCFT I on a semi-infinite cylinder of infinite radius. But because you are dealing with conformal field theory, it doesn't matter which disk you are calculating the partition function on. Zi is always proportional to Ti, namely the mass of the D brain associated with BCFTi. And so you see that the inner product xi mi xi mj is proportional to Ti, the mass of the ith D brain times delta ij. And this clearly shows that xi mi can be interpreted as a solution that represents D brain associated with BCFTi, okay, because the inner product of xi mi with xi mi is simply proportional to the mass of the ith D brain, okay, the D brain associated with BCFTi. If we take the solution psi m, which is the sum over the xi mi's, then we can calculate the inner product of psi m with itself, and this is the same constant k times now the sum of the masses of the tensions of the ith D brains. Okay. And hence it's clear that this superposed solution psi m will represent the superposition of n D brains corresponding to BCFT1, BCFT2, etc. And now I should also note that I have not made any assumption that these BCFT i's for different i's are different from each other. Okay. Some of the BCFT i's can be identical. Okay. And this means that we are not only able to describe in this language different D brains, superposition of different D brains, we can also describe superposition of identical D brains. Okay. Some of the D brains can really be the same. Now, before I try to give the proof of the relations, okay, that I wrote down, I'll just make some remarks. The first remark is the way I have defined the solution xi m I, it seems to depend on this real parameter epsilon. Let me flush the expression once more. Here is the expression for the definition of xi I, and it does have a real parameter epsilon sitting inside. Now, the solution certainly is different, at least it looks different for different values of epsilon, but they have the same tension because the tension depends only on the partition function of BCFTi. It doesn't depend on epsilon. Okay. And there is a strong reason to believe that these solutions for different values of epsilon are in fact all gauge equivalent and describe the all describe the same d-brain associated with BCFTI. So even though the solution does depend on epsilon, they are just gauge related to each other. Now, the second point I want to mention is that if for some I, BCFTI is chosen to be the same as BCFT0, the reference boundary conformal field theory, then we can choose chi I plus minus to be identity operator. Okay. Again, we can go back to the this language over here. You can see that chi I plus minus, for example, has the property that on one side of it there is BCFTI boundary condition, on the other side it's BCFT0 boundary condition. So if BCFTI is the same as BCFT0, we can in principle choose chi I minus to be just the identity operator. Similarly, chi I plus to be the identity operator. In that case, the corresponding solution is just given by this. Okay, because chi I plus minus becomes identity and the epsilon to the 2hi factor becomes 1 because hi is 0. And this is precisely the sliver that Barton defined this morning. Now, I should say here is that it's not necessary that you have to choose the chi I plus minus to be identity. You could choose chi I plus minus to be vortex operator of excited open string states in BCFT0. Okay, and that will give a different representation of the same d-brain. Okay, the BCFT0 d-brain, but a different representation. And for d-brains in flat space time, many of these general constructions can be carried out explicitly using oscillator representation. Okay, this is something that Barton described in the morning, but I'll not try to do this here. Okay, so now I'll try to give the proof of the results that I quoted, namely that sigma I star sigma j is delta ij times sigma I, and that the norm of sigma I in the matter sector is proportional to the mass of the corresponding d-brain. Are there any questions so far before I start discussing the derivation? Okay, so let's try to describe the proof of the results. Okay, why does sigma I star sigma j gives you delta ij times sigma I as ii? Okay, so recall the definition of xi I again. Okay, the inner product of xi I with any state phi in H is given by this expression over here. F of z is tan inverse z, and phi is any state in the Hilbert space, phi of 0 is the corresponding vortex operator. Now, what we will do in analyzing this is to regard this xi I state as limit of a sequence. Okay, and this limit of a sequence will be in the same spirit that Barton described the sliver in the morning as a limit of OH states. Okay, the m goes to infinity limit of OH state m. So sliver I will be written as limit of n goes to infinity sliver I n, and we will define sliver I n by exactly the same expression as given here, except that the correlation function will be evaluated not on the upper half plane but on a cylinder. The way we will define this cylinder, this is a semi-infinite cylinders which I'll denote by c hat n, is the following: that we take this z hat plane in which to begin with was upper half plane, and now restrict to imaginary zn hat larger than 0, and instead of allowing real zn hat to run all the way from minus infinity to infinity as we will do in an upper half plane, we will identify real of zn hat. We will first restrict the real part of zn hat in the range minus n pi over 4 to plus n pi over 4 for some number n, and identify the lines minus n pi over 4 with plus n pi over 4. So zn hat will be the same as zn hat plus n pi over 2. Okay. So clearly in the n goes to infinity limit, this range becomes infinite and we recover the upper half plane. Okay. But the regulated version of this will be a correlation function on a cylinder, on a semi-infinite cylinder. Okay, we will simply take the zn hat plane and restrict the real axis, the real zn hat in some range. Now, how does it relate to the picture that Barton drew this morning? Well, it relates it in the following way. So we have said that we restrict zn hat in the range minus n pi by 2 to plus n pi by 2, okay, minus n pi by 4 to plus n by 4, and then make an identification. But once you have made an identification, you can shift the zn hat coordinate in any way you like. Okay, it's just a periodic coordinate, so it doesn't matter which range you take in the zn hat plane. So we take, we equivalently take the zn hat to be the with the cylinder to be described by in the by the following range of coordinates. Imaginary zn hat is larger than or equal to 0, and real zn hat will now take from minus pi by 4 to n by 2 minus 1/4 pi. Okay, so instead of making it symmetric around the imaginary axis, we'll just push most of the region to the right of the imaginary axis. So to begin with, in the zn hat plane, we had an insertion of chi I plus at pi by 4 plus epsilon, okay, which was here, and an insertion of chi I minus at minus pi by 4 minus epsilon, which was here. Okay. But once we have taken the fundamental range to be in this region, the chi I minus which was here now gets put here. Okay. Because after all, this line is identified with this line. So left of this line is the same as left of this line. Okay. It's just a different range of the same cylinder. So in this language, we can regard the inner product between xi I n and phi as 2 epsilon to the 2 hi, and then f dot phi 0 xi chi I plus phi by 4 plus epsilon, this is this insertion, and chi I minus of n by 2 minus 1/4 pi minus epsilon, okay, which is the insertion that is given here. And now we see that if we replace chi I plus and chi I minus by identity, then you recover precisely Barton's picture of the sliver. Okay, this is the z hat plane which came by taking the infinite helix, okay, and making the exponential map. Okay, that converted the infinite helix into a semi-infinite cylinder. Okay, the shaded region over here is the image of the local coordinate patch. Okay, so if you take the upper half unit disk, mod xi less than or equal to 1, imaginary xi greater than or equal to 0, then under the map tan inverse xi, this region gets mapped to the shaded region over here. So this representation of the state xi I n is useful to calculate star product. Okay, because we will see that using this representation is extremely simple to calculate the star product of two such objects. So first let me say in words what we need to do to calculate the star product of two such states. Okay, so take two such states xi I p, okay, regulated by putting it on a cylinder c hat p, and xi j n regulated by putting it on a cylinder c hat n. So we have two cylinders, okay, c hat p and c hat n. The first step is that you remove the local coordinate patches, okay, from both cylinders. So if you have a cylinder and the local coordinate patch is a strip, okay, so if you remove a strip from a cylinder, you are left with a strip, okay, semi-infinite strip. Okay, because you have just removed the cylinder. So this then leaves us with two semi-infinite strips of which p plus p minus 1 by 2 pi and n minus 1 by 2 pi. Okay, because the semi-infinite strips have been removed, the local coordinate patches. The second step now is to join the right boundary of the first strip with the left boundary of the second strip. Okay. So you have two semi-infinite strips, we join them together. That gives another semi-infinite strip of width of with p plus n minus 2 over pi, just the sum of these two. Okay. Then we glue back a local coordinate patch, which has a semi-infinite strip of width pi by 2 to this strip, and then identify the left and right boundaries of the resulting strip. Okay. I'll draw pictures which will probably make this manifest. Okay. Before I do that, let me just show this once more. Okay, so in this z hat n plane, okay, we'll denote by Rn the white region, okay, the region that is obtained after you have removed the semi-infinite strip, okay, because this is the region which is used for gluing. Okay, so here is the picture, okay, here is the picture of the glued surface. So we have Rp, this is the semi-infinite strip that you get from the C hat P, this is a semi-infinite strip that you get from the C hat N. Okay, so you have glued them together, then you glue back the local coordinate patch, and then finally you identify the left and right boundaries to make this into a cylinder again. Okay. So the what is the result then? You have, after you have done all this, okay, the result is that we now have again a semi-infinite cylinder, okay, of a bigger radius. The total radius is that of this plus this width over here, that's the total width. Okay. And we have a chi I plus chi I minus insertion. This is from the first sigma I p, and a chi j plus chi j minus insertion. This is from sigma hat, the xi j. Okay. So here is the full algebraic expression of xi hat I, xi I p star xi j n. Okay. So we have first of all this normalization factor, which came by taking the product of the corresponding normalization factors that appear in these two individually. Then we have a chi I plus of pi by 4 plus epsilon, that's this, chi I minus of p by 2 minus 1 fourth pi minus epsilon, which is this, then chi j plus, okay, right here, and chi j minus over here. Okay. This then is the expression for xi I p star xi j n. Okay. And you will ultimately take the p and n goes to infinity limit to recover the full, the actual state that you are working with. Now, what we will do next is the is following. Then now we will use the fact that because this is periodic, because this line is identified to this line, we can pull this chi j minus, which is only epsilon distant away from this end, to this place. Okay. So we can pull this chi j minus and put it here. Okay. So you have chi j minus here, chi j plus chi I plus here, and f dot phi 0 here, and the chi I minus chi j plus here there. Okay. So this is what I will write down explicitly now. Okay, so this is the expression for xi I p star xi j n. Okay, the same expression, but just that chi j minus has been pulled by using the periodicity to minus pi by 4 minus epsilon. This is pi by 4 plus epsilon, and then there are these two extra insertions. Okay. But now we have to take p and n goes to infinity limit. Okay. And now we notice something simple that happens. If we take p and n goes to infinity limit, we see that these pair of vortex operators move to infinity. Okay. Compared to these three vortex operators, these three vortex operators remain at finite point in on the real line, but these pair of vortex operators move to infinity. Okay. And this means that only the identity operator in the operator product of these two vortex operators is going to contribute to this correlation function. Okay. Any other operator is going to fall off as this operator is moved to infinity. Okay. So now we notice, we recall that if I is not equal to j, then this correlation function goes to 0, because chi I minus chi j plus has all operators dimension larger than 0. Okay, this is the way you have chosen our chi I plus minus. On the other hand, if I is equal to j, then only the identity operator contributes. Okay, so and that this means that we can simply replace the second set of chi I minus chi j plus by 2 epsilon to the minus 2 hi times delta ij. Okay. And I should emphasize here that we have not taken epsilon 2, we have not assumed that epsilon is small. Okay. The reason that we pick up only the leading contribution from this operator product is simply because we have taken this pair of operators and moved them to infinity. Okay. So even for finite epsilon, we just get the leading term in the OPE. Okay. And so we get finally then the relation that we wanted, xi I star xi j. Okay. With phi is given by this expression over here. Okay, the second pair of chi I plus minus have been replaced by delta ij times x minus epsilon to the minus 2 hi, and this is precisely the relation that you want. Okay, because you now identify this, okay, as the sliver state again, or not the sliver state, as the xi I state again. And so you see that this establishes the relation that xi I star xi j is equal to delta ij times xi I. Okay, the relation that we wrote down in the first place. And now if we split the xi I into a matter part and the ghost part, okay, this part of course is independent of I. Okay, so I shouldn't have probably written the I here in the first place. Okay, this doesn't have any I dependence. Okay, we recover the relation that xi m I star xi m j is delta ij times xi m I, okay, and hence the string field configuration psi m, which is obtained by superposition of the xi m I's, does satisfy this relation over here. Okay. And so we are able to construct this way a projector in the Hilbert space of BCFT naught, okay, satisfying this equation. Okay. So now we move to the second relation, because we need to now try to calculate the value of the action associated with the solution, okay, to determine its tension, which means that we need to calculate this inner product, and that in turn means that we need to calculate this inner product over here. Now, using this regularized picture of the states, it's in fact quite straightforward to calculate this inner product. Okay. So I'll first state the steps that are required for calculating the inner product. Okay. So basically what we do is that we start from the expression for xi I m star xi j m, okay, using the regularized form of these objects, okay, and then perform a pair of operations to calculate this inner product. So the idea is that you take the expression for xi I m star xi j m, which involved a geometry of this form. Okay, this is the geometry which appeared in the computation of xi I star xi j. Okay, now you are looking at the matter part only. Okay. Then the first step is that you remove this local coordinate patch. Okay, if you want to calculate the BPZ inner product, you remove the local coordinate patch and then you simply identify this line with this line, okay, instead of identifying this with this line. So here is the are the steps written in words. You remove the local coordinate patch from this cylinder, big cylinder, okay, that leaves us with a strip of width p plus n minus 2 times pi by 2, and then you simply identify the left and right boundaries of the resulting strip. It's like you are using the identity state to simply glue back a star b to form a with b, the inner product of a and b. So geometrically, okay, this is what happens. Okay. We had the region, white region rp and white region rn. Okay. In the computation of the star product, we also had a local coordinate patch over here. So that we have removed, and we are now identify the left and right boundaries of the resulting strip. Okay. And this is what gives us the inner product xi I m with xi j m. Okay. So whatever you see in this figure is what is written here. Okay. First of all, there is this overall normalization factor given here. Okay. And then we see that in the correlation function, we have a chi I plus at pi by 4 plus epsilon, chi I minus at p by 2 minus 1 fourth pi minus epsilon, chi j plus here, and chi j minus here. And now we'll again pull this chi j minus over here, because we have a periodic identification of this line with this line. Okay, so chi j minus and only epsilon distance away from this boundary, so it's better to put it here and make them within 2 epsilon distance. Okay. And we'll see that what's going to happen here. Okay, that once you have put this chi j minus here, these two vortex operators are close to each other within a distance 2 epsilon. Okay, close means they're finite distance away from each other. These two vortex operators are also finite distance away from each other, but this range and this range expands to infinite distance in the limit p and n goes to infinity. Okay, because this distance is of order p and this distance is of order n. So this is the final picture. Okay. We have a chi j minus, a chi I plus, okay, a chi I minus and a chi j plus. Okay. The boundary conditions on the real axis are as follows. Here you have BCFT J boundary condition, BCFT I boundary condition, and a BCFT J boundary condition. In these regions, you have BCFT not boundary condition. Okay. And now we see that this pair of vortex operators are pulled infinite distance away from this pair of vortex operators. Okay. So again, you can use operator expansion to expand this vortex operator, this product, and this product. Okay, in a series of operators, and the only operator which contributes, okay, is the identity operator. Okay, because every other operator has vanishing correlation function when they are pulled infinite distance away. Okay, just by conformal word identities. Okay. And so the net result is that, first of all, if I is not equal to j, then there is no identity operator in this OP, no identity operator in this OP, so the result is zero. If I is equal to j, then we get back the partition function of BCFTI, because this region basically, okay, so this operator gets expanded to just the identity operator. So you have BCFTI boundary condition here, and again BCFTI boundary condition here, because J is the same as I. So the net result is that the whole cylinder with the boundary of this whole cylinder have just BCFTI boundary condition. Okay. And so here we then get the partition function of BCFT I on this cylinder times this normalization factor, because this OP involves 2 epsilon to the minus 2 HI, and this involves 2 epsilon to the minus 2 HI. But this normalization factor of course cancels with the explicit factor that we have put in the definition of the states. Okay. So the net result is just the BCFT I partition function on the cylinder. Okay. And this is what we wanted to establish. Okay. So this then tells us that, okay, so this partition function in turn is related to partition function on the disk, okay, because this, I mean, by conformal transformation, this cylinder can be mapped to a disk. And so you see that we get this relation, okay, this partition function is proportional to tension of the D-brain that is associated with BCFTI. So that we have this relation over here, and we clearly see now that if we take the superposition of n such states, we get the tension of the sum of the tension of those n D-brains. Okay. And this means that this solution is representing the superposition of n D-brains corresponding to this defined BCFTI. Okay, now let me just make some remark as to what happens if we try to repeat the above analysis, okay, by replacing BCFTI by a theory which is not conformal. Okay, the bulk is still the same conformal field theory. Okay, bulk you are not touching. Okay, but imagine that we have tried to replace, instead of using BCFTI, instead of using chi I plus to separate a BCFT not boundary condition from BCFTI boundary condition, we use this vortex operator to separate BCFT naught from some non-conformal boundary condition. Okay, so from non-conformal boundary field theory. Now, if we recall how we calculated the star product, if we use the z hat coordinate, calculating the star product never involved any conformal transformation. Okay, it simply involved just a shift. Okay, and under this shift, nothing happens to the operator, so it is your partner. Okay. And so formally at least, okay, provided we can take care of suitable ultraviolet regularization of this boundary field theory, okay, we have to use some kind of ultraviolet regularization to describe this boundary field theory. But formally the relation that xi I star xi I equal to xi I still goes through. Okay, because we still have two BFTI put side by side, and the net result is the BFTI partition function on the cylinder. So we still have these relations, xi I star xi I equal to xi I, and the most of the steps that are involved in the computation of this inner product also goes through. Okay, that we can calculate the xi I m with xi I m, and the net result then will be that we get the partition function of BFTI, okay, a non-conformal field theory, boundary field theory, on this semi-infinite cylinder of radius half pi times p plus n minus 2. And we now have to take the p and n goes to infinity, and in this limit the cylinder radius goes to infinity. So what does such a solution represent? Okay, what is the physical interpretation of a solution of this kind? Because this solution does not correspond to, at least does not seem to correspond to, a D-brain, because D-brains are associated with boundary conformal field theories, okay, not a generic boundary field theory. But we see that what we have ended up by this process is the partition function of BFTI on a cylinder of infinite radius. Okay. Now, if you want to relate this to something that we understand well, okay, we need to bring it back to partition function on a disk. Okay. And the way to do it is to first bring this cylinder of infinite radius to a cylinder of finite radius, okay, and that requires an infinite rescaling. Okay. And this infinite rescaling, what it does is that it drives the BFTI, okay, the boundary field theory, to its infinite fixed point. Okay. So even though we started with a boundary field theory, okay, we got the boundary field theory, okay, on an infinite radius RT. Okay. And to make it into something sensible, to relate it to something that we know, whose result we know, we have to first make it into finite radius circle, and during that rescaling process, we are basically driven to the infrared fixed point of the FTI. Okay. And that of course is a boundary conformal field theory, and so the interpretation simply is that this state that we got with BCFTI replaced by BFTI represents the D-brain associated with the BCFT with to which this boundary field theory flows in the infrared. Okay. So this clearly gives many ways of generating a solution for a given D plane. Okay, they look very different, but they have the same tension. Okay, and these different solutions are all expected to be related to each other by string field theory gauge transformation. Okay, so more or less near the end of my talk, let me end with some future short and long term prospects of this field. Okay, so clearly the most pressing problem at this stage is to fix the Gauss sector. Okay, you will hear about it from David Gross tomorrow. Okay, and I think we should really look for a pair of Q and psi G such that this object is actually finite. Okay, it doesn't have funny behavior. Okay, that this is really finite. And I think all the developments about the ghosts are basically narrowing down our possibilities. Okay, that we really are getting tighter and tighter constraints as to what kind of operators and what kind of states we should look for. Okay, to make this into a finite result. Now, I don't have much more to say about this except to note that if we calculate this inner product, okay, I am just giving an example of a appropriate correlation function which is finite, which is just one. Okay, and that's this correlation function. Take the full sliver, okay, matter times psi g, and sandwich the operator c del square c in between the two slivers. This we know is just one. Okay, this can be calculated explicitly. This is the dimension zero primary. This correlation function is just one. Okay, so one idea is to try to look for psi g and q so that we end up with this equal to this. Okay, and that will manifestly make it finite. Okay, how to do it, I have no idea. Okay, but this might provide a clue to how we could try to obtain psi g from the sliver. We certainly need to extend this to superstrings. Okay, either use Borkowitz version or some modification of the cubic version. Okay, and again, we don't have really much idea of how to go about it, except that my feeling is that the projectors, okay, the equation psi star psi equal to psi in the matter sector will still simplify a lot the equations of motion for a general superstring field theory. Okay, in the tachyon background. Another challenging problem is to find the closed strings. Okay, Barton already described this in the morning. Okay, now we can see that there should be at least there is an indirect way of saying that the closed strings are there in some sense. Okay, just consider two classical solutions in this string field theory which describe a pair of D bends, okay, a certain distance apart. And we know that if we calculate the one loop effective action in the background of this pair of D bends, we do have the closed string exchange interaction. Between the effective action does contain the closed string exchange interaction. So it's clear that the closed strings are hiding in some way or the other. Okay, the one loop effective action in this theory does contain some information about closed strings. The real question is how direct we can make this. Okay, how we can make this more direct, okay, where we can see this closed string by just by doing loop calculations or some other calculations in the vacuum itself, okay, without invoking the D-bends. Now, even if we find perturbative, okay, I should say perhaps at this stage that a model calculation was done by Minahan in the context of periodic string theory, and he did discover some poles in one loop, okay, although these poles look very different from the kind of poles that will give rise to closed strings, but they are certainly, one should investigate these kind of poles also in the context of vacuum string field theory. Now, even if we find perturbative closed string states, we need to know how to shift background, okay, the closed string background. And the kind of techniques I described here, okay, where you use a boundary condition changing operators, okay, the generalization of those kinds of techniques may be useful in also describing closed string background deformation. Again, this is something that Barton alluded to in the morning. And it's clear that what we need to do, what we need here, okay, is a way to understand conformal field theories where it's not that you just have defined boundary conformal field theories on two sectors of the boundary, okay, but that you need to construct domains, okay, in this upper half plane, okay, so that inside say the semicircle, a unit semicircle, you have one conformal field theory, and outside the unit semicircle you have a defined conformal field theory, bulk conformal field theory. Okay, if we could make sense of such objects, then there is a hope of finding closed string deformations in this open string field theory by doing exactly the same kind of techniques. the instead of using boundary condition changing operators, we will have to use conformal field theory changing operators. Okay. And finally, I should say that if this program is really successful, then we may be able to use the open string field theory around the tachyon vacuum to really give an on-perturbative formulation of string theory. Okay. This theory has no perturbative physical degrees of freedom. All non-trivial dynamics comes from solitons and bound states, and it's certainly worth exploring what it means for all holography and counting number of degrees of freedom in our world. I think I'll stop here.
Thank you. Any question?
This is related to a question I think I've asked you before. So the factorization of ghosts and matter is important in your whole formalism. And we know that when we have D-brains around, we in effect turn on dilaton fields. And so there will be, and those are notorious for mixing ghost and matter degrees of freedom. So where exactly would that show up in this formalism? Is it just an order, say, G squared correction to all of this?
Yeah, or? I think when you try to do the one loop correction to this, then clearly the factorization of matter and ghost will not be there anymore, because that will induce the closed string backgrounds. But at the tree level where you are working, okay, then you don't see the dilaton. Okay, so at that level, it's still factorized.
Yeah, I was getting confused about a rather simple point. So you described all these states associated with changing the boundary conformal field theory. But string field theory is supposed to be independent, I thought, of the choice of background for the open string fields, the choice of, so is it somehow the difference between your BCF0 and BCFI which matters, or?
Yeah, see the point is we have, string field theory is supposed to be independent of the choice of the reference boundary conformal field theory, but the explicit form of the action of course depends on BCFT0, okay, because you can do all correlate calculation of correlation functions in BCFT0, okay, and there is a complicated change of variables. If you want to build your string field theory on not on BCFT0 but say on some other BCFT, you have to make a complicated change of variables. Here we have chosen one set of variables because we have already said that our string field takes value in the Hilbert space of BCFT0, and we are trying to describe a solution in that set of variables. And so we want to describe BCFTI D-brain as a solution in that set of variables. Okay. And that and this prescription tells you how to do that.
So bosonic string requires basically an energy momentum tensor B and Q to start formulating it, not C. C, the ghost, the anti-ghost is not necessary for the formulation. There are string theory backgrounds, bosonic string, which don't have C. How do you deal with those kind of cases in your formalism?
Which don't have C? Meaning what kind of background?
C cohomology is trivial in this case, but there's bosonic string backgrounds. For example, when you have C equals to 1 with Terman cosmological constant, where C disappears.
Okay. Well, it could be that the Q will be different in that case.
Right. So an example of these are any topologically twisted theories, which have Q, B, and T, but not C. C is an extra data that you don't generally have.
Okay.
How do you deal with those?
So it could be that you have to build Q differently in that case.
In the discussion of D-brains in general conformal field theories, you usually hear about Cardy's condition and the Goldilocks problem, the question of deciding which things are actually D-brains. And it seemed as if in your discussion, none of that entered. You just used a general conformally invariant boundary condition on your closed string field theory. Am I right about that?
What you have assumed in this analysis is there's a three-point correlation function that we are using to define our xi I state. That's a well-defined correlation function. Okay. So that already, assume that we have taken a consistent set of D-brains, okay, that we have already made a choice of what are the consistent set of D-brains in a given conformal field theory background, okay, which correspond to some specific Cardy states, presumably.
What was there in your derivations that depended on that?
No, I don't think there is anything in the derivation which is dependent on that, but we are using this correlation function. And ultimately, when you try to deal with these xi states, we have to make sure that these correlation functions are consistent correlation functions, the three-point correlation function that we have used. See, because when you, for example, take the star product of xi I with xi j or something else, right, then in general you get a multi-point correlation function of these vortex operators. And you have to make sure that these multi-point correlation functions of these vortex operators all satisfy the necessary conformal identities. Necessary identities of that a correlation function in a conformal field theory should satisfy.
I see. So you say that's where these conditions will come in.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, I have a comment and a question. So if you look at the very baby example of the structure of open and closed topological field theory, then it's a very important question is what's the center of the open algebra? Now, you've shown that there's a large center because you exhibited all these orthogonal projection operators. But the question would be, if you think your methods could identify what the center of the algebra is. And that's an interesting question, because if you, again, look at the structure of the algebra, the center of the open algebra is isomorphic to the closed algebra when the center is semi-simple.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer this general question.
Any further questions? Okay, so let's thank the speaker again.